This episode of Reality Check is about permaculture with our guests Jen Head and Jean Griffith. You've probably heard terms like regenerative gardening, no-till gardening, and organic gardening, of course. We'll be finding out about these notions of how to work with the natural world while helping ourselves and the planet, too. Hi, guys. Hi, Jean, and hi, Jen. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks,
Great.
Lee.
Glad to be here.
I'm so glad you could come down. Like I think I mentioned earlier, Jen, before we started taping, that this is an area I know absolutely nothing about. I've been hearing about it for years, and I'm embarrassed to say I really don't know what permaculture is. Could you start by just kind of defining it a little bit?
Well, it's interesting. It started out as permanent culture, as sustainable agriculture, mm-hmm. and it morphed into permanent culture. Mm-hmm. So it's changed over the years from what it started out as just organic gardening, as you said, mm-hmm. to realize that it's a much bigger thing than that, that it encompasses quite a bit.
So permanent as in sustainable.
Even more, our strong sustainability is
resilient.
The way I like to think about it.
Resilient.
It can withstand change. In fact, uses change to its benefit. Oh. So we prevent destruction because we build systems that can withstand that type of destruction.
So when we're talking about climate change, this is one of the big pluses about permaculture? Well,
it's so important with climate change. When we plant a tree, we sequester carbon every time. We need to plant more perennials and grow more plants, and that's just part of the solution, of course, but it's a big part. Mm-hmm. And if we learn how to do that sustainably, without using fertilizers, without using tilling, without using pesticides or herbicides, we're doing the world a favor, and we're helping ourselves as well.
Right, right. So when you're talking about no-till gardening and regenerative gardening, those are part of permaculture then?
Those are techniques that we use. So we have a strategy, say we want to grow food, and then how are we going to grow food? We use different techniques to do that. One of the techniques is no-till gardening. So we build the soil up versus tearing it down.
So how do you do that?
Jen, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So for example, go out into a forest mm-hmm. and look around. Nobody's tending it. Nobody's watering it. The plants are kind of right where they need to be in certain niches. And so those are the types of things that we try to mimic when we're growing food or planting a tree. We plant plants together in guilds.
Guilds?
In guilds, yeah.
G-U-I-L-D?
Exactly.
Like apprenticeships.
Yeah, because they're networked together in nature.
Yeah.
And they support each other.
Right.
And so also that's a good way to increase diversity as well.
So in the old battle days, I mean, primitively, that would be like when they started doing rotation agriculture, well, they'd plant a field in clover in between planting it for food.
Yeah, exactly.
Things like that.
And
but
so
at a much more sophisticated level.
Yeah, I mean, so for convenience, we sometimes grow plants in rows and in squares with 90-degree angles. That's a good way to do it. You can also grow plants together in that way with companion planting. You can also decrease the amount of energy that you have to put into that system.
I'm all for that.
Yeah. Who isn't, right? I mean, that's more part of a healthier us as well.
Mm-hmm.
By companion planting and, like you said, using cover crops, also using ground covers that don't outcompete your annual vegetables.
And they hold water, things like that.
Yeah, they're a living mulch, essentially. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have bark mulch to use, you can use a living mulch like chickweed, or I find that our native wood sorrel doesn't really outcompete any plants, and it's also edible. But when you're creating your garden space, and say you have a lawn or something that you want to convert, in our case, we have a lot of blackberries and crocosmia
mm-hmm.
And some other plants that are nice, but not a whole entire property full of it. You can use techniques like putting down cardboard and straw and maybe some manure or some grass clippings and start to build layers that will smother the underlying growth, right? So that stuff dies
back. So in other words, when you clear some blackberries, a way to claim some of the land for yourself, you can use these techniques to keep it from coming back.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And when they die, they'll rot in the ground, providing even more organic matter.
Mm-hmm.
Using cardboard is really good for making pathways, but also can take a little while to break down. So Jean and I were talking earlier about, was it the origin of no-till gardening? What was the woman's name?
Ruth Stout. She uses straw, mm-hmm. and all she does is lay straw
Just
down to
straw.
create to create our beds, as well as to prevent weeds and to hold moisture and to plant the seeds right
yeah,
in.
Yeah, but I'm so excited because I don't know, now I know what to do with all those Amazon boxes.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I feel so guilty every time I get something from Amazon.
No, don't get rid of them. Yeah. The worms love them. And if you want to use the cardboard, straw, manure, whatever you have, compost laying around technique, what I do is I take a tool. I use a hori-hori, but you could take a knife or some tool.
What's a hori-hori?
It's a Japanese gardening tool that has a serrated edge on one side, a point at the end, and then a sharp kind of knife edge.
All-purpose.
Yeah,
with a
very
long handle, I bet.
Their tools are the best. It's actually a short handle,
oh, okay.
But it's very ergonomic.
Mm-hmm.
But you can just stab a hole in the cardboard to put your plant in, and then by the time your plant wants to spread, if it's perennial, the cardboard breaks down pretty quickly here if you expose it to lots of moisture. So the fall and the winter and the spring are really good times to start putting down cardboard.
It's
and covering up. Yeah.
So is that the no-till idea, that you keep the ground covered and then they stab something through to put your plant in?
Yeah, or, you're really just building on top of for no-till. You, say eventually you do eradicate your grass or whatever it is that you're trying to cover, and then you want to keep building on top of that system. So when you till, you disturb, there's horizons in the soil layers. And you know, there are lots of microbial communities and invertebrates that are mm-hmm. occupying those layers in specific places, just like in the forest. And when you till it up, you disturb that whole ecosystem, essentially.
Yeah.
So when you cover and you grow some crops and then it ends up maybe getting a little depleted, you can just keep adding compost on top of it
mm-hmm.
or grow your green manure, take it from somewhere else and lay it on top or grow it right there and cut it back before it goes to seed, and keep building on top of that, that space that you created.
Green manure being some crop that you...
Being crops, yeah.
Yeah,
being
just
nitrogen
because
fixing.
It makes...
Yeah, nitrogen
exactly.
fixing is what I was going to say. That you really want to take plants that actually pull the nitrogen out of the air mm-hmm. and put it into the ground. They do that with microbiology that's actually mm-hmm. in the roots of the plants.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of the microbiology and the plant pulls the nitrogen out of the air. You cut the plant when it's time to plant other plants, that releases the nitrogen into the ground. And therefore, you're fertilizing the ground without buying fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
There's trees that do that. There's plants that do that. Locust is a tree that does it. Mm-hmm. Clover is a plant that does it. Any legume does it.
We just planted some moringa, actually.
Right,
I'm not
quite
sure how it'll grow here. We'll see. But, yeah.
So the nitrogen is fixed into the ground that way. Is that also the way the carbon dioxide is captured too?
Oh, that's a little different because carbon dioxide is actually taken out of the air by the plant and turned into carbon in the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, a tree, when it grows up, it can hold tons of carbon mm-hmm. and very low cost. So you plant mm-hmm. some small little tree, you can end up saving tons of carbon for pennies. So
right.
that's the beauty of carbon sequestration with trees. They store a lot of it, and it's a very low cost. We need to be planting millions, if not billions, of trees to counteract climate change.
I think I heard this recently, that trees are more effective than just garden plants or vegetables
right.
and things
annuals
like that.
Annuals are going to disturb, typically you're going to disturb the soil to plant annuals.
Mm-hmm.
So annuals are good for eating and everything, but really we need to probably switch more to perennial foods
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
that way it takes a lot much less energy to grow, and they produce for years. Apple tree might produce for hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah.
So that we can eat apples, we can eat nuts. There's chestnuts. There's quite a bit of things you can make out of the flower of them. So there's lots of ways to approach that.
Yeah. I think trees maybe sequester carbon better because of just the sheer biomass.
Right.
Yeah.
They have to
and
produce a lot of
storage too, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And underground. There's much underground as on top quite
a lot. Oh, that's right.
And
the
focus on perennials also ties back into what we were saying earlier about decreasing the energy that you are having to put into your systems,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if you grow an annual kale, which can sometimes be perennial here because of our climate, but if you grow an actual perennial kale, you don't have to buy the seed or save the seed and start the seed and plant the start.
Right.
It's something that comes back every year. For example, I've got perennial arugula that tastes just like arugula. It's a little bit spicier than the annual arugula, but I scattered it everywhere, and it's coming.
Just letting it grow wild.
Yeah,
really.
And it's really just like kind of like a weed, quote unquote, in my around my fruit trees and stuff.
Yeah,
because if you don't put something there, nature will. So it might as well be something that you want to be there. So now in its second year, I have all these great arugula plants coming back, and I didn't have to do anything. You know, they're just there and they're
so
ready to harvest.
So if you want those kind of varieties of a say, a vegetable plant that you're going to be going to eat, and it's you want to get a perennial variety, is that something you can just access on the internet? What's the best way to, like, tap into this?
Yeah, I would look. There's lots of seed companies focusing on perennial vegetables, like Experimental Farm Network was one I encountered recently. I've also been doing a lot of seed swapping on Instagram with people that I've from all over the country that I met. I've got some seeds coming in the mail from a friend in New Jersey who got seeds from her her uncle on there, you know, an island in Greece. And I'm sharing seeds with other people, and they're sending me seeds or roots to plant. I've got some sea kale growing from Food Forest Card Game out of Rhode Island, and I sent him some fava beans and perennial arugula in exchange.
So how does that fit with what you're talking about earlier about having the sort of companion growing that fits with the environment? I mean, I'm assuming that the best thing for the environment is the plants that already want to live here naturally. But you're bringing in things from other places, but I suppose they have very similar microclimates, and you have to do that research.
Well, it's really important. Like, you know, real estate, they talk about location, 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 same in permaculture. You need to not fight it, try to go with what you have. And what you do is, when you have a group of plants, like a guild, if there's a particular niche in that guild that you don't want, you put something in that you do want in that guild, so you just replace that one element. So if it's a vine, perhaps you don't use a blackberry vine, perhaps you use a kiwi vine or something like that to be the vine, because there's seven different layers you can grow as well, you know, when you're thinking about planting.
So when you say a guild, can you define that a little more clearly? I'm still a little confused.
Well, it's a group of plants that work together. So the classic one is the three sisters that the Native Americans used. So they had the corn was the like the trellis, okay? And then you had the squash that grew up the corn and that covered the ground, so protected like a mulch. And then you had the beans that were part of it that actually was nitrogen fixer and provided the fertilizer. So all three of them working together created a system that was a guild.
Are there some other sort of classic combinations like that?
You know, they're...
Well, they're each different. Like an apple tree, if you look at the permaculture manual, it has about the apple tree and all the different plants associated with apple tree. And there's quite a few different ones. Like comfrey was one of them. So there's different jobs that you want each little plant to do.
So it's more about selecting, okay, like a family. You want buddy and sister and the dog and, you know,
Somebody's a digger. Somebody's a fertilizer. Somebody's a protector. Somebody covers as a mulch.
Somebody makes a structure like the corn does.
It also depends on your location, too. So, or even the location in the guild. So on the north side of a fruit tree, for example, there's going to be more shade. So you would want to put something there that was tolerant of the shade, like a currant bush, you know, for example. And I don't think I would be able to grow corn very well on my property.
Not around here.
So I would, you know, substitute something else for as the trellis plant, you know what I mean? So it really kind of depends on where you are. Also, in terms of native versus bringing in perennials to eat, there's kind of an equation that you have to balance. Part of permaculture is, you know, the three, the foundation of permaculture are the three permaculture ethics. There's care of self, care of people, care of the earth, and then there's sharing surplus. And while native plants are awesome, and I do my best to cultivate them and use them medicinally, I can only use so much salal personally in my life, you know. And I have a lot of salal. I like salal. It's very useful. I like the berries. It grows in places where a lot of other plants won't. But you can also use plants that are more useful to you as food or as mulch or as forage for your animals that have similar requirements to salal. So they like acidic soil, for example. But the more plants that you're growing to eat the food from, the less trips to the grocery store, to wherever you have to make, which cuts down on fuel consumption and cuts down on the fuel consumption used to get the food from wherever it was grown to you.
Which is huge.
So
I think I read the other day that the average vegetable comes like 1,500
a million
miles
bazillion.
Or 3,000 miles away.
Yeah. Food miles are horrendous.
Incredible.
Might as well
right.
be,
oh my God.
You know, somewhere on the other side of the earth mm-hmm. when, you know, you could be growing something. You could be growing your salal and cultivating your native plants and also growing things that have a yield for you. Yield mm-hmm. meaning something off of it that you can harvest.
Not to mention, if we do have a natural disaster, I think it takes 3 days for the grocery stores to be out of food.
Oh,
and that
yeah.
would be especially true here. We just lost Hoosconagon Slide
exactly.
again. And, you know, we didn't have gas for a
right.
day. We didn't have many things at the grocery store for a long time.
Right.
There were a lot of things like that that happened just from
yeah.
one of our little arteries being
yeah.
cut off.
And mm-hmm.
I've been here when they've all been cut off at
it's
once.
It's true. And having, you know, having a lot of diversity in your system really helps it to be stronger, but also you to be stronger. Mm-hmm. We were cut off for a day in Port Orford because the 4 mile flooded to the north, which it does every single year.
Yeah.
And then the slide happened to the south. So for, you know, yeah. for one day we were isolated.
It was new in Gold Beach, really, basically.
Yeah, it really makes you think mm-hmm. about what would we do, you know, and you just, I would rather have diversity in my system, you know, because
yeah.
it's more resilient that way.
Yeah, rice and beans get old after
and
a while.
And so do salal berries.
And we always need water. You know, yeah. water is another thing we need to be saving, and we talk about even saving things like water. We need more than one source. If the city water goes off, what do you do?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So rain barrels are very important. Things mm-hmm. like having, mm-hmm. Being catching that rain that we get so
storage
much.
Storage tanks.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we can talk about, too, the permaculture has 12 guiding principles, 12 or 13, depending.
Well, I've counted 75, so I keep going with the principles.
Well, but some of them can be like subcategorized under other
right.
principles.
Yeah.
You know, but catch and store energy is one of the principles.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, if you can capture sun energy or capture wind energy or capture and utilize water, like Jean was saying, you know, it's one of the things that makes the system more resilient.
Right, and especially with the water around here, as
yep.
things heat up, it's getting more and more.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard that the CHETCO is already overcommitted, and, you know, there isn't much room for any more growth, even though people are trying to do it anyhow. And,
true.
You know, just a lot of
and
things about the
wells
water
running
that we have
dry.
To be aware of.
So
yes,
last summer, I think
yeah.
it didn't rain from basically early June until almost September.
I know.
Maybe rained once or twice on the ends there, but not in the middle
yeah.
at all.
Yeah, I knew people that had been on the same piece of property for decades. It had never gone dry before and went dry.
Yep.
So that's something to think about
yep.
our future.
We're lucky enough to have a year-round creek that flows through our property. It was a big plus for me in purchasing the property. I probably would have bought it without the water, but having the water there makes it feel really secure for
yeah.
us, you know?
Yeah.
Like we could really make a go of it if we had to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the principles are really interesting because they're patterns in nature that nature has built on because they're successful patterns.
Yes.
So nature uses these patterns all mm-hmm. the time. So not only does nature have rivers and creeks, it has rain and has the ocean. So lots of different ways that it actually occurs. But it happens in lots of other principles too. Like no waste is a big principle in permaculture. We want to create systems that don't have waste. Waste is a resource typically that we just don't think about. We throw it away.
Can be
in permaculture,
back.
There is no way. Mm-hmm. We're on one planet. It's a finite planet.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take care of our home.
Recycle it back into your system. Even, you know, something as simple as toothbrushes. Think about all the toothbrushes. We use them as plant labels. We flip them bristle side down into the mm-hmm. ground and write on it and use them to label plants. Really, there is absolutely no way. Everything, you know, possible gets reused and recycled back into the system.
I love that. That's
mm-hmm.
great.
In nature, there's no waste. It doesn't waste anything. Everything is used. Unfortunately, we haven't learned that lesson totally yet, but we're headed that way.
Yeah. Yeah, we sure are.
Out of sight, out of mind, right?
That's right.
Has to go somewhere.
You were talking about the water thing. How does the actual cultivation of plants and permaculture contribute to the water?
Well, there's lots of ways we do that.
Mm-hmm.
Hugel cultures comes to mind because I like it a lot.
What's that called?
Hugel culture is the mound culture from Germany from 3,000 years ago.
Mm.
And what you do is, there's several ways to do it, but one main method is you dig a trench, you put wood in it, and you cover it with soil. And that actually allows you to plant perennials into that and actually retains water because basically the wood soaks up the water. and you
it acts like a sponge.
And it also is fertilizer because it's organic material, so it's decomposing over time. And so it's a great way to not have to water as much, get great growth.
Yeah, and use a real soft wood for that, I imagine.
Well, it could be any kind of wood because, again, nature does it all the time. Now, cedars don't decompose as quick as, you know, oak, but they all decompose, you know.
But you might be careful about using the plywood out of your remodel job because it's full of junk.
Right. Yeah, you got to be careful not to use poison. So, you know, you don't want to use railroad ties, for example, with the creosote in it. Yeah, that would be good.
There's probably a better place for the plywood on the side of a compost bin, maybe, or something.
Well, it makes you realize that, you know, you're out. A lot of times when you don't really realize the poisons are all there, but when you start looking into it, there's poisons all over the place that we really need to avoid and not buy in the first place to try to keep out of our
system. And that's one of the other concepts, I imagine, is that you want to have a system that is working in balance so much that you don't need all that stuff.
That's right. The perfect permaculture system would be a system that not only creates outputs that we enjoy, but its own inputs. In other words, we don't have to add anything to it. It's like nature. No one is planting in the forest. The forest is reproducing by itself.
So that's the holy grail. How close do you get to come?
Well, you know, we're getting better and better at all kind of things. So I imagine if we looked at it, we could probably get pretty good at that. Again, all we have to do is follow nature's example. Nature's already doing it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, take a look in the forest or in a ditch even and see what's growing there and how everything's working together to sustain itself. You know, if you plant a medicinal herb, for example, a dynamic accumulator like comfrey around your fruit trees and you don't do anything, at the end of the season, the leaves die back and they fall around the base of the tree and they provide nutrients will go, you know, from those leaves into the soil, also providing.
You call that what kind of accumulator?
Dynamic accumulator.
Dynamic accumulator. So that means it's
pulls nutrients up from deep down in the soil.
Deeply
rooted. It's a miner and it's pulling up those elements.
So tell me more about these basic tenets that you
The principles?
Yeah, the principles.
The principles are really interesting, and it's one of my favorite parts of it because, like I said, it's like, to me, engineering background, the principles are the formulas, and the resources are the variables. So I put those two things together, and I have solutions. So it's a great way to put solutions. But one of my favorite one is multiple elements support multiple functions. So if I'm going to put an element in my yard, I want it to do more than just one thing. So not only is it going to provide food, it's going to provide fertilization, for example, or a mulch or shade. It's going to do more than one thing. And anything I choose to put into my system should do more than one thing. That gives me resilience and it gives me all kind of connectivity.
It's called stacking functions. Yeah, so it could be beautiful is a function.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something makes you happy, but it also is good for pollinator plants, has, you know, nectar for bees or and then it also maybe produces something edible and then, you know, makes good compost or good mulch also. So
that's on the element side. And then the function side is, okay, water is important. So I need multiple elements supporting that water function. So I need the city water. I need the creek. I need the rain barrels. So you have multiple elements supporting that function and multiple functions supporting.
So, again, there's that resilience.
Very much so.
Yeah.
The resilience is what you're trying to define.
You're listening to KCIW LP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. So that's lovely. Are there any other of these principles that really stand out to you that you'd like to share?
Another one is observe and interact. So I like to tell people who are wanting to start to implement permaculture design on their property to wait 1 year before you make any major decisions, any infrastructure that you're going to build or anything, you know, that's not temporary, because it really takes that long to figure out what's happening, where all the energies are coming from, for example. Really want to pay attention to things like the angle of the sun or the direction of the wind in the different seasons. For example, my son and I moved onto our property in the winter, and we got really excited by all the good sun it was getting on a part of the property. We put in some fruit trees, and we planted potatoes. And then our giant maple tree leafed out and created more shade than I could ever have possibly imagined.
Oh my gosh.
And our potatoes were thriving and they withered away and the fruit trees never thrived. So those kinds of things, I mean, those weren't really permanent, you know, decisions that we made, but Had they been, we would have been disappointed, you know, and we were disappointed. We didn't get any potatoes. Our potatoes after that really only got a little bit of sun in the morning and almost no sun for the rest of the day. So what we ended up doing was moving the fruit trees to the drip line of the maple tree.
Right.
So they're right on the edge. Uh-huh. They're not underneath. And then also, if it ever does rain in the summer when it's leafed out, you know, the drips will kind of fall right on the fruit trees. So observe and interact. Observe your space and your ecosystem, you know, and then act appropriately.
That's great if you are a good observer. And I think I'm very impressed listening to the two of you how much time you've probably put into learning all these things. Can you say a little bit about how you got into it? What's your background? How long you've been doing all this?
Like a lot of people, I think I had been practicing permaculture a lot longer than when I had discovered it. So there were things that were kind of intuitive to me and patterns I had already observed in nature. And then when I learned about permaculture, I was like, oh, wow, it's actually a thing.
And you could go and read what other people had to say and get some support.
And then, you know, and then learning more details about it, of course, everything just kind of came together for me. But originally, I had loved plants my whole life and science, and ended up getting a PhD in biology from the University of Oregon.
So you've just been immersed since day one, really.
In science, since I could crawl, basically. Mm-hmm. And I had a strong interest in forest ecology, but ended up studying marine biology. And I was in academia for a while, and then I ended up having my son, and I was. It became clear to me that I wasn't going to be able to do both effectively, be a scientist in academia and be a mother, the mother that I wanted to be, because it was very demanding of my time.
Right.
And so we moved back to Oregon, and I started apprenticing as a natural builder. And sort of discovered permaculture when I was living out at Cobb Cottage in Coquille. Mm-hmm. And in 2014, I did my permaculture design certificate. We call it PDC through the Oregon State University has an online program.
Oh, really?
Which was ideal for me because I was, parenting and doing other work. And then I also took an advanced design course as well through Oregon State. I think that was in early 2015.
Yeah, it's amazing the programs that are out there now.
Mm-hmm, it is.
And Gene, do you want to say something about your background?
Yeah.
And
sure, I started out in engineering a long time ago. And like in the 80s, I studied engineering, electromechanical engineering, and majored in robotics, and did automation career for 20, 30 years. And so I was very interested in solving problems and with different customers, and I would go and call on them and help them fix their machine, make it better, faster, stronger. And so I always liked solving problems. I had been retired kind of early and started looking at permaculture. Mm-hmm. Now, what was that? To me, I came at it from a different direction, kind of similar to Jen here, is that I came at it through natural building and renewable energy. A lot of people come at it through organic gardening.
Right.
But I found out about it because I was into renewable energy and how we're going to solve this problem of crisis with oil and climate. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I discovered it. And when it hit me, I knew it was the right thing to do. The yes was so big in my life that I knew not only did I want to study this, but I wanted to teach about it. Mm-hmm. So I look, where in the United States is the best place to do that? And South Oregon is one of the best places to do it.
So I
came to 2010 is when I came to Southern Oregon, and I got my PDC and I started teaching right after that. And I took a teacher certificate in 2011 or so, and I've been teaching since then.
Why is this such a great place?
That's a good question. I don't know. If we just have good folks here in Oregon. We're lucky.
Okay. So you just felt like there was a real community that was interested in this.
And the teachers were here, and there was examples of the farming here, and people know about organic. It's not like organic gardening is a mystery here. No. A lot of people are familiar with it. But other parts of the country, it's not as big.
Mm-hmm.
I came from the Southeast U.S. I was born in Georgia, and there was very little organic gardening going on. There's more now than there was
when I
left like 15 years ago or whatever. But it's grown up quite a bit.
I think a lot of people find when they discover permaculture that, A, they've already kind of been doing it, and B,
you pick up things like that.
Yeah, you do, and it just makes sense. Also, it's kind of the perfect marriage between science and your personal ethics, you know? For me, science was, I was doing a lot of bench work, molecular biology, biochemistry. It was very wasteful. I was ending up with trash cans full of plastic gloves and pipette tips and tubes. you know, and so it was like kind of hurting my heart a little bit. And then when I discovered permaculture, it was the perfect marriage of my interest in science and ecology and, you know, my desire to do things that were good for the earth.
Mm-hmm. I love the automatic efficiency of it, where the nature had figured out the systems that were automatic, didn't take inputs, but yet still controlled the system very accurately. And yet also changed and adapted to change. These are systems that man have very
difficult
things to design.
Can you give us some examples that people might relate to of what you're talking about?
Say, for example, how compost works.
When
a leaves drop on the ground, when nobody has to tend to it, it turns into compost. The compost turns into fertilizer. The tree is fertilizing itself. It's a system that's automatic. Nobody has to do anything for it. Mm-hmm. A beautiful system. I had been using compost all my life. But mm-hmm. when I started looking at it through the permaculture eyes, I started realizing, well, there's all kind of examples.
It's like all that. Happening.
It's yeah, happening yeah, all yeah. around us. We just need to take those patterns and apply them in our life.
I once knew a guy, this is years ago, and he had the most gorgeous garden. And he would take his kitchen scraps, the vegetation, mm-hmm. and just make a little hole in one of his furrows and stick the stuff in there. And mm-hmm. that was his composting.
Yep. Perfect.
He didn't do anything.
That's a great way to do it.
Put it back on the ground.
That's yeah. you
can
do.
And, how low energy is that? You know?
Right. You can even build, I've seen people build little cages into their beds and put, you know, throw the scraps in the middle so that the nutrients, they break down and kind of seep into the surrounding soils is another mm-hmm. way to do it. But yeah, dig a hole and bury every time or
yeah.
Have one area. You know, it's good to have it close to where you need it.
Right,
you know, you need
exactly.
So
in your kitchen.
Yeah, and if you're, we've got compost bins that we built out of pallets mm-hmm. Close to where we need to use the compost. Mm-hmm. But if you could put it directly in the soil or in a cage that's in your beds, it cuts down that step of transporting it,
right?
You know, you want to move
well,
things.
Well, I've always thought
possible.
Of composting as a sort of complicated thing where you have to turn it and make sure the pH is right and all this stuff. And apparently, if you stick it in the ground, it's already
it can be
there.
You know, I had a pile that
I think he had a great garden that was already
yeah.
full of worms and
right.
everything you needed, right?
Yeah, I had a compost this compost that I was turning regularly, and I was on top of it, and it was heating up really nicely. And then I just got too busy, and I just didn't have time to, you know, do that, and
right.
it turned into a giant worm bin. We get a lot of, because Port Orford is a fishing community, I have neighbors that are fishermen. We get a lot of fish guts. I get a lot of texts that say, fish guts, ? Mm-hmm. And then I say, absolutely. And then I bury them in my compost, and that doesn't really lend itself to turning too much because it's really
that
stinky.
Would be, yeah.
Yeah. And so the worms love it. Just let the worms go at it. And now if I take it and turn it, I add some straw, you know, for carbon. It is teeming with worms. I'm talking like dozens and dozens and dozens of worms in just a handful of mm-hmm. the compost.
I've seen that around here.
Yeah.
It's a very wormy
mm-hmm.
place we live in.
Let them do the work, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, so this is absolutely fascinating. If people want to learn more, can you point towards some books or some way to hook up with the community? I know you're going to have a class. And why don't you say a little bit about that, and then we'll mention it again right at the end so somebody can grab some paper or something and write it down if they want to.
Okay.
But what do you think, if somebody like me who just going, this is fabulous, but I know nothing, where do you start? A good book or what?
Well, I would recommend taking classes. There's lots of really good free information on YouTube and on the internet. For learning how to design, it's really nice to have some hands-on practice for that. When I did my PDC, we used a book called The Earth User's Guide to Permaculture.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rosemary Marrow is the author. Mm-hmm. And that was a really accessible alternative to Bill Mollison's Permaculture Design Manual, which is a very thick and technical book.
Yeah.
Jean and I started a local permaculture guild, South Coast Permaculture. Yeah, and we've got an online group, and it's a little bit slow right now because it's winter, but we're hoping to pick up in the spring and summer with
it's time now. We're in April.
Some meetings and some site tours of people's, you know, permaculture systems.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing a class April 6th. This might be over by the time this airs, but we'll be doing another one in the summer.
Right.
In July, we'll
land.
Be doing another. We're hoping to.
You're going to do another one when?
In July. We haven't set a date yet.
In July.
Yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll let you know.
So,
that
that would be great. If you can let us know, maybe we can hook it onto the podcast that gets on our website.
Sure.
People can look up some resources that way.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think you told me earlier, this one anyway, is going to be $35 per morning versus afternoon session, or you could take both of them.
That's correct. We're going to have an intro to permaculture in the morning, mm-hmm. where we talk about the ethics, principles, design features, and how to do design. And then in the afternoon, we're going to do a design workshop, the charrette, where we're actually going to have a design for the Pacific Sunset Inn that will have the participants making designs. So we'll actually get to practice what they learn in the morning. So probably mm-hmm. the morning is kind of an intro. The afternoon is more of advanced. And mm-hmm. hopefully we'll get people where they can actually start understanding what they need to do to design their own gardens.
Sounds wonderful. And you mentioned the guild. You want to say something about how to connect with that right now? Because that's something that they will be able to still connect with.
Sure. It's groups.io. It's a new format for me. It's not a Google group or a Yahoo group. And I think if you Google Southern Oregon permaculture, it should pop up. But okay. We could put our contact information in the show notes maybe, and people could
sure.
get in touch with us if they're interested in joining.
That would be great.
We can send them
invitations. But Southern Oregon permaculture on Google, and they should be able to find you.
They should be able to. And there's also Southern Oregon Permaculture Institute, SOPI, which is
a nonprofit, it's a 503c nonprofit that we do education. And we're doing
that
in Gold Beach.
So you're part of that group too?
Yeah, I'm the executive director of that.
Oh, okay.
And we're trying to do that more and more. We have been doing it in Ashland in the last 6 years, but the farm got sold, so I moved it to Gold Beach here. And so we're starting it up here.
Hmm.
And this is one of our first classes that we'll be doing at this coming Saturday. And then we'll plan on having more every quarter at least.
Great.
And people are coming out of the woodwork a little bit. You know, every time we go somewhere and talk about permaculture, somebody says, oh, do you know so-and-so? They're interested in permaculture. And then, you know, so our group is just kind of expanding that way.
Yeah. I have 5 acres on Cape Farillo, and we're part of Coastal SoCan around here, some of us. And we're going to try and do something with no-till gardening up there as a kind of a community project. And that's just sort of on the drawing board right now. But there's a lot of interest in these things, especially as the whole climate change crisis is becoming so much at the forefront of people's minds these days.
Yep.
If people want to find out more about the Southern Oregon Permaculture Institute, they can go to sopermaculture.org, by the way. And there is questionnaires in there, design questionnaires, and you can start answering these questions, get an idea, start thinking about what is it that you really want? What is it that you really want to do? How much work do you want to put into your garden?
Right.
Because some people don't have
the time
to do it. But if you do perennials, you don't really have to do much time.
Mm-hmm.
And annuals take a lot more time. So there's ways we can fit every schedule, so to speak, and every amount of energy.
Say that URL again, please. The
S-O permaculture. SOPERMACULTURE.org.
S-O for Southern Oregon, permaculture.org.
That's correct.
Okay, great. Well, those are all good things. Okay, here's something completely off subject. You know, we are a monarch butterfly city.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of folks are really interested in milkweed and don't know a thing about growing milkweed. Is that an ecologically friendly plant to plant on your property? What do you think about growing milkweed for the butterflies?
Yeah, I would do it absolutely.
Yeah,
the deer loved mine to death last year, so I'll be planting more milkweed this year.
Yeah, that's a big thing here. I mean, I used to think, well, I still do actually in my private thoughts, that we should just call this Deer City.
Yeah.
There's all these deer wandering around our neighborhoods going, I used to live here. I still do live here, but it really looks different, you know?
Right. Well, we've got an issue in Port Orford where people are actually feeding the deer. So the deer have come to associate the humans with food. We're surrounded by tens of thousands of acres of wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
But the deer, they've come to rely on people for sustenance.
Right.
So when there's no natural predators and there's an unlimited supply of food, it creates kind of an ecological disaster. And so the deer are a big problem in Port Orford.
Too. I mean, if you're restricted to things they won't eat, that's not a big menu to choose from.
Well, I've heard people say at nurseries that the deer in Port Orford will eat pretty much anything. They're exceptional when they say, oh, this is deer resistant, this is deer tolerant.
Forget about it.
The deer don't know they're not supposed to eat it.
Yeah.
they ate my artichokes. They browse last everything. They're browsers.
Yeah.
Nothing's
nothing's
nothing sacred.
Nothing's
not safe. Really. Fences work best.
fences. That's right. It. Big, good tall fences. Fences.
Yeah. There's right. another thing I wanted to highlight, too. We talked about diversity a little bit, but one of the principles is use and value diversity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, putting milkweed and putting all these other species on your property increases the diversity of your system and also increases the stability kind of your system, you know, because everything's working together in kind of a supportive net. If you think about, for example, a monoculture like corn, tens of thousands of acres of the same crop.
Right. And then you get tens of thousands of acres of the same bug.
Right. Exactly. Right. And how much energy and how many chemicals you have to put into that system to get to, you're essentially fighting nature. Because
exactly.
nature doesn't, that's not how nature rolls. So if you can, the more species that you can put into your system, the better, really the better off the whole system will be. You won't have to use chemicals. It's less work for you because if you have chickweed growing throughout your plants, you don't have to worry about weeding unless you want to use the chickweed in your salad because it's edible or, you know, medicinal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of my favorite principles other than integrate rather than segregate. And we've been talking about integrating things the whole time.
So even though we live in a mostly fur-based forest culture,
right?
Bringing in fruit trees and nut trees and other kinds of things like that is actually a good idea.
Very good idea. We should really need to get away from the monoculture tree culture even. Have a variety of trees that should normally grow here. And with climate change, it's likely to change anyway. The thing is that plants don't move fast enough. So the climate may change faster than the plants can adapt. And there you have a problem. Because either you're going towards a forest or you're going towards a desert. And we don't want to have, of course, luckily we have a lot of water here. But over in the valley, over in Ashland, it's with 20 inches of rain, some years and some years less than that, it can definitely turn desert-like. So hopefully in the future we'll take care of that.
On that note, you're listening to KCIW LP, Curry Coast Community Radio 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon, which is beautiful partly because we have all that bloody water.
That's right.
Hopefully we keep having it.
That's right. It's funny because we get plenty of water, but it comes at the wrong time of the year. We really need it in the summer, and it comes in the winter, so that's why storage,
to
Jen's point, was so important.
Yeah, and the Checo, they say, is mostly rain-fed, not snow-fed, so that's...
Well, think about how consistent our rain is. You know, when we think about the rain, it's the same per year, year after year after year. With climate change, that stability is going to go away. Mm-hmm. That's the scary part.
Yeah.
We don't know what it may get more likely to rain here, may get less, but we don't know, and that's really we need to take
care
of. Just
in the nearly 20 years that I've lived on the southern Oregon coast, I believe that we have changed a whole entire growing zone, you know, the USDA, the climate zones. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that when I first moved here, we were 8B, and then somewhere in between, we were 9A, and I really feel like we're 9B now. I'm growing subtropical plants in Port Orford, and not only because I have microclimates, just because it just doesn't really get as cold as it used to, and it's a lot warmer, I think, in the summer as well.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I know this past winter was very cold, but I don't want to make the mistake of saying that the weather is the climate, because it isn't.
That's right.
Right. Nope. They're different.
But it did worry me a little bit that it seemed awfully cold last winter.
Yeah. And if you notice, our friend Michael Crowfoot, another permaculturist in Port Orford, he pointed out to me that the Doug firs are dying back at the tips. And the Doug fir is not really a drought-tolerant tree. And they're planted in monoculture, a lot like corn. You know, they spray chemicals to get to keep the land clear, and then they replant them. But, you know, our ecosystem, our economic system, to a certain extent, is based on around the Doug fir and logging. And I think some people don't really see the need to act until it hits them in the pocketbook. And that might be, you know, suppose the range of the Doug fir shifts to the north. That could be really catastrophic for
and
our economy.
And it's already happening with fishing. So we are kind of in a little frog in the beaker now, getting warmed
it's
up.
It's not as far off as it seemed before.
It's in process. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
I mentioned the cold winter because actually my point is that it's not so much that we can predict that it's even going to be predictably warmer. We could have like really cold years and really warm years. It's chaotic. It's not stable.
I like to call it global extreming, actually.
Yes, that's right.
It's really just extremes of all kinds of weather patterns, you know, be it a seismic patterns or, you know, snow or droughts or tornadoes or hurricanes or or anything, you name it. And it's a more extreme version of what it was before.
I think about control systems back from automation days. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a sine wave. You're kind of in a consistent, nice, smooth pattern. As things get chaotic, it starts going very high and very low, very high and very low. Mm-hmm. And then you reach some point where the set point changes. So you're not going around one point anymore. Now you're around a different point. We don't know where that point would be. It may be 200. I mean, I don't want to be too scary, but it could be 100 degrees different. We don't know what will happen.
Yeah.
Venus is not livable. You know, so and at one time it had water on the planet. You know, so we don't know what can happen to the Earth, but we need to take care of it because we have consciousness and we understand we can change things. We can change our behavior. Mm-hmm. And killing the environment is not a good behavior.
That's right. You were talking about a documentary a little while ago we got on the air about that you thought was such a hopeful piece. And I love bringing things like that forward. Yep. I feel like my perspective is that even 6 months ago, we were all doom and gloom. Now it feels like people are getting mobilized and so much is going on in terms of positive forward movement that I'm starting to feel hopeful again.
Yeah, there's a lot of awareness. The documentary is called Living the Change. And we saw it at the Wild Rivers Land Trust. They've been showing climate change movies. But the reason that I liked it so much is that a lot of documentaries focus almost the entire time on how bad things are, and it's all gloom and doom, and it's really depressing. And then maybe at the end there's a glimmer of hope, you know. But this one was just kind of a little introduction to the gloom and doom that we all know is happening. And the rest of it was focused on solutions and things that we can do, feasible changes that we can make. And permaculture was a big part of that puzzle.
Right. Yeah.
David Holmgren talks about, and he goes a lot about ethics. And one of the ideas is that we don't really be pessimists. We don't want to be optimists. We want to be realist and be a positive aspect on that realism. And that's what we're trying to do. Permaculture is trying to be real about what we need to do. Understand that change is going to happen and try to do the best we can with it.
I was reading a book. I'm going to try and pull it up here if I can grab it real quick. It's called Act of Hope. Now, I don't know if I should absolutely recommend it because I haven't finished reading it, but it says how to face the mess we're in without going crazy. And it's by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnston. But what I liked about it, it says there's three places you can be. You can be business as usual and just put your head in the sand, or you can be in despair and just assume there's nothing that can be done, or you can be proactive as this group is trying to be, and really put your energy into making things different. And that's the one place to be that is actually functional, that actually makes you feel good. So, you know, who knows how this all turns out? We're on a great adventure together to find out what's going to happen next. But, you know, the only place to really be, I think, feel good about yourself and what you're doing is to be actively pursuing some of these outcomes.
I feel like I like to do my bit and the bit of several other people at least as well.
Yeah.
People who are maybe not quite there yet or over-consuming. You know, I do my part and then some. So.
And if we all just could carry our own little bucket in the bucket brigade. It would be a really different story.
It would be, team. I mean, and like you said, there's kind of an awakening happening. People are really catching on and we're, you know, it's kind of a bipartisan thing. It's crossing political lines. People are from all, you know, walks of life are feeling the pinch and feeling concerned and, you know, wanting to make changes. So another thing I'd like to plug too is the Global Earth Repair Conference that's coming up in Port Townsend the first weekend in May. I think it's the 3rd to the 5th. And my good friend, inspiring friend, Skeeter Pilarski is organizing that. So I'll be going up to that, and you know, anybody else that wants to carpool along is welcome to come. They can find it by Googling Global Earth Repair Conference online.
Sounds like a good one. Okay, well, we're down to a last little while here. We've got about a few minutes left. And I'm just wondering, what have we not covered that you would really like to get sorted out here before we're done?
Well, I'd like to see everybody at least plant something, you know, as soon as possible. Because the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the next best is right now. Mm-hmm. So let's plant something. It's mm-hmm. easier than you think. You don't have to have a green thumb. Stick it in the ground. Nature will do the rest.
Okay.
I'm really confident that nature will take care of it.
And would you recommend the fruit trees and the nut trees as providing
fruit
food
trees,
or
I think
anything
are,
in particular?
One of my favorites, apple trees. They do great here. Mm-hmm. Raspberries do fabulous here. I get tons of raspberries. Mm-hmm. Blackberries do well. Blueberries do well. Mm-hmm. So we can have delicious.
A lot of superfoods there.
There really are.
Walnuts are a superfood.
Oh, yeah.
These are things that are really healthy mm-hmm. for people, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, and it's important to have local sources of protein, you know. I mean,
right. Not to mention how expensive walnuts and other nuts are in the stores nowadays.
Yeah. I know, it's true.
So getting your own would be a really
would
good
idea.
Would
be amazing. Yeah. Another permaculture principle that comes to mind, and we've kind of touched on this a bit, is small and slow solutions. So if you're feeling kind of overwhelmed by, oh my gosh, the weight of the world is on my shoulders, I have to save the earth, I have to redesign my whole property to be permaculture friendly, you know, just start small. You know, figure out where the angle of the sun is, where the wind comes from, where the water runs. And you don't have to change everything at once, and you don't have to make big changes. You know, it's actually better if you kind of make small changes, and then you can kind of step back and say,
learn by doing.
Yeah, take a look and how's this working? You know, this is not working. So then, you know, because if you make kind of radical big changes and things don't really work out, you know, then you've invested a lot into it.
Right, and too many factors to even know what happened.
Exactly.
You know?
So small and slow solutions is what I would recommend to people. Just a little bit here, a little bit there. Maybe cover your lawn and, you know, start planting some strawberries and asparagus there instead, or, mm-hmm. you know.
And they're so good.
Yeah.
And there's support out there. Like you said, you've got your online support group going. And
right.
And if you're just putting your toes in the water, there's classes and books and things to do. And there is help out there, even locally, folks like you that are mm-hmm. deeply involved and available for yeah. consultations and online support yep. and things like that.
And so Absolutely. Many free resources online, really.
Yeah.
So many. There yeah. is even, I think Oregon State even does a free intro to permaculture course. I believe it's Andrew Millison, the instructor, who is also the instructor for my PDC. So also look for that.
That's an online course.
Yeah, through Oregon State. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not a certification course, but it's a free introduction to permaculture course. And pretty sure that somebody that I know took it and said it was amazing. But I know Andrew is a really inspiring teacher. So I would, if people have structured time that they want to set aside to learn and don't just want to kind of look for, you know, YouTube videos in their spare time, that might be a good place to start.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And so you're up there in Port Orford doing what you're doing mm-hmm. with Wild Rivers Land Trust. We've had Anne on the show before.
Yes.
And so are you somewhat integrated with them at all? Or
Well, just the fact that Port Orford is a small, supportive community. Mm-hmm. And we all kind of support each other in our endeavors, and we all have similar interests. So, for example, for our workshop, I don't have a printer at home, and I went to the land trust, and they printed my posters out for a small donation to the land trust, you know. So we just kind of, we're really good at working together. At the co-op, I'm also involved at the Port Orford Food Co-op, and we got a grant from the city to start a permaculture demonstration garden. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be happening next to the co-op this spring.
Oh, nice.
It's really exciting, yeah. And so we're pretty heavily involved in that. People are already starting to propagate plants and save seeds for us. And really, it's just the community in Port Orford really kind of rallies around things like that. So
I also know there's like these, excuse me, seed banks where they save heirloom seeds and things mm-hmm. like that. Is part of this going back to these heirloom strains? Is that something?
Well, that's really important, yeah. Because if you get hybrids, they're not necessarily you don't own them, for one thing. If mm-hmm. the heritage brands, you can have them, you can save the seeds, you can spread them around. But if it's a copyrighted seed, that's really owned by the seed company, and you're not supposed to propagate.
And a lot of them are sterile.
Yeah.
A lot of them are sterile
God.
Anyway.
They do that on purpose, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and they could have pesticides or insecticides built right into them. And that could be very dangerous that you really don't want in your garden.
Yeah, oh, not mentioning any names, but there's one company in particular that
starts
does that.
Starts with an M and ends
with an
O.
Starts with an M. They also make the chemicals that you would need to grow it. And right. now, because they've merged with another company whose name I won't mention, they can also make the chemicals to treat the illnesses that you get from the chemicals that you need to grow their sterile seed.
And that you eat.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly.
What a brilliant concept.
I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've got it going on.
So the heirloom seeds are important. I know there's these seed banks that save all these exotic seeds. Mm-hmm. And that's something else you can probably tap into online.
Yeah, well, also there's a lot of local seed communities. So, for example, up in Coquille, there's the I think they had to change their name to Seed Library, maybe. I'm not quite sure what they call themselves now, but they have semi-annual or maybe even more often seed swaps mm-hmm. where you can go and trade seeds with people who've been saving seeds or who have extra seed. And it's a good way to kind of spread the love around, you know, and help people save money so they have to expend less energy and they have more time in the garden. But we're hoping to do that kind of thing at the permaculture demonstration garden at the co-op to have seed swaps and also teach people how to graft fruit trees and prune fruit trees and actually demonstrate permaculture there. That's why
we need to get you down here more too.
If I could,
you know,
if
I'm sure
I could,
you have plenty of time to do all these
things.
If I could
clone myself, that might work out.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you could come up to, you know, some of our classes in Port Orford and see permaculture in action, learn how to create a hugel bed or learn how to do sheet mulching with cardboard mm-hmm. and straw or learn how to graft your own fruit trees.
So aside from the fruit trees we already talked about a lot, vegetable-wise, how many vegetables that we're familiar with, commonplace ones, can be got in the perennial type of seed?
Well, they're not. Sometimes they're not seed. Like tree kale,
or
it doesn't
starts.
Have seeds.
Yeah.
Well, you have to propagate it from a cutting because mm-hmm. it doesn't. The whole reason it's a perennial because it never comes to seed. If it actually went to
gotcha.
Seed, it would finish.
Right. You know, me and my botany. But anyway,
I would say more than you think.
Yeah. More than you think.
I encountered the other day somebody talking about a perennial pea. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to get. I think they said Renee's out of California. Renee is a seed company, maybe.
And they would have things like little cuttings and starts and things of that nature.
Yeah, or
you could
if
work
they
with.
Had seed, you know, some perennial plants can be grown from seed, like the perennial arugula. Mm-hmm. They might be shorter lived, for example. But yeah, and I'm all for, you know, having to do less work. So
yeah.
And having, you know, these plants establish themselves and be a regular part of the ecosystem. And also, I grow vegetables, you know, in fruit tree guilds and not just, I mean, we've only been on our property for 2 years, but we haven't really established an annual garden area yet. We have one staked out finally, but we are, you know, we're rebuilding our house and so many projects and infrastructure and woodsheds, and we just haven't really had time. And then we had a massive deer problem. But I have a cabbage plant growing next to an olive tree, you know,
right.
and a goji berry growing up next to my peas that are climbing a trellis, you know, so.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the ways I did it was with the straw bales. I just took six straw bales, laid them together on a driveway and planted right into, it was a gravel driveway, planted right into it with just a little bit of compost. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can plant.
That's amazing.
And it turned into soil in 2 years. Now it's soil.
Yeah.
Or it was compost.
Well, we're going to have to draw this to a close. I'm sorry we could go on and on. I'm having so much fun here learning about all this. I want to thank Jean Griffith for coming out and chatting with us today. I have Pi White here as technical support and co-producer, and this is Lee Tooley. Thank you all for listening to Reality Check on KCIW.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.